This is a reading from Job, chapter 19, verses 23 to 27. Oh, that my words were written down. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with iron pen and with lead that they were engraved on rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at last, and that the last will stand upon earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, then in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another.
The second reading is from Luke, chapter 20, verses 27 to 38. Some Sadducees, those who say there is no resurrection, came to him and asked him a question. Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers. The first married and died childless, then the second, and the third married her. And so, in the same way, all seven died childless. Finally, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the seven had married her. Jesus said to them, those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they are like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. And the fact that the dead are raised, Moses himself showed in the story about the bush, where he speaks of God as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now God is God, not of the dead, but of the living. For to God, all of them are alive.
Thank you to the Gilmar Stoddard, Gilmar clan, who are helping us with worship this morning. So appreciate it. Oh, well, thank you. She's been knitting this while she was up there, finger knitting. I love it. Purple, you know, is the royal color. I just want to put that out there. This past Tuesday, a few of us had a chance to listen to Mr. Ben Lee, a human rights activist, who shared with us some of his experiences over the last 10 years in particular, in which he was working first in Afghanistan, then in Iraq, then in Syria, and then in Myanmar, with the United Nations, with a team in each of those places. And his task was basically, in each of those places, with his team, to gather together the understanding, to document the atrocities that had happened in each of these places. It was soul-sucking work, really, to listen to him talk about it. And it was a fascinating talk, one that I was sad that there was just a very small handful, but so encouraged by what he had to share on his way back to Australia, I said, when you come back through here, I want to stay in touch and I want to make sure that we offer a chance for you to speak again to our own church and to the wider community, because what he had to share was so very important. And part of what he was sharing was that their task in collecting the documenting the atrocities was really to give an opportunity for the people in these regions to tell their story, to tell their stories. And the truth is, one person's story isn't probably going to change the whole world. Those stories are like pixels. Chris, do you have a first slide that you can throw up for us? I want you to think about our stories as being like pixels on a screen. And so there are individual stories that we might have. It's a pixel here and a pixel there and a pixel there. And they seem in some ways disconnected. But the reason why the people tell those stories is because as they begin to tell the stories, patterns begin to emerge. Chris, if you can show us the next one there. As those pixels come together, patterns begin to emerge and a bigger and broader picture comes together. And ultimately, the hope is for people like Ben Lee, who is gathering together the stories of these people in these different regions, is that enough of those pixels come together, enough of those stories come together, that they then begin to create a composite picture. Chris, if you can show the next one. And those pixels come together to create a composite picture that hopefully gives us hope, hopefully gives us an opportunity to think about ways that we might indeed change the world to give possibility for folks who are in the midst of a world in which it seems like there is no possibility. Pretty picture, we'll take it down now so we can see even prettier people in Zoom world. When I think of the Bible, I think of the Bible in the same way, that it is a collection of stories, those stories each being pixels that help to create a more composite picture when we look at the whole story that is there. The Bible is a collection of 66 books, each of those books with a multitude of chapters, each of those chapters with a multitude of stories in a vast variety and genre of storytelling. And yet, as we read them, those pixels begin to come together. Sometimes they come together in such profound ways that the whole story is told all at once. When Jesus says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself," that's the entire pixelated picture, all there, all for us to see. When the disciples say, "He is risen, Christ is alive," that's the whole picture. But most of the time, the stories give us just a little bit that becomes part of the greater picture that we need to see. Today's scriptures are a perfect example of that. And the story of Job that Emma just read for us, five verses in a book that is in the top third of the size of books that are in the Bible, in terms of words and verses and chapters. And we have five verses in a whole three-year lectionary span in which there are verses from the Hebrew scriptures and verses from the Gospels and from the epistles and the Psalms. Every week, we only hear the book of Job a handful of times. We hear the first chapter, we hear these five verses in the middle, and we hear the end. There's so much more in the story of Job that we kind of need to fill in just to know what this pixel tells us. But this is smack dab in the middle of the book of Job. Job at this time has gone from this person who is admired in the community, a person who is handsome, a person who is wealthy, a person that has great respect wherever he goes, to one who is disfigured, one who is impoverished, one who is disdained, particularly disdained by his friends. Who, as you read the book of Job, you understand when people say, with friends like these, who needs enemies? His friends who gather together for him for the bulk of the entire book of Job to basically say, "What did you do, Job? What did you do to make God so mad at you? You must have done something here, Job, to make it bad, because this is not good and it must be your fault." The portion just before what Emma read for us is this lament that just breaks your heart. In the six or seven verses before what Emma read for us, Job says, "I have become abhorrent to everyone. My family doesn't want to be near me. My acquaintances, they run away from me. Those who used to work and serve me now want nothing to do with me. My skin hangs off my flesh. I smell so bad that I am loathsome to my wife, and I am pursued by people like you, friends, who want to tell me what I have done wrong." This is the lament that Job has for us in the middle of the book. And yet, in the midst of that lament, Job finishes that and then says those words that Emma read for us: "I know that my Redeemer liveth." In essence, he is saying, "I know that my present reality is not my eternal moment, is not my eternal reality. I know that God is not yet done. I know that my Redeemer liveth." In the midst of all of this going on, "I know that my Redeemer liveth." That is a pixel in the great story that tells us so much. Now, the truth be told, when he says "my Redeemer," the Hebrew word is a word that is goel, G-O-E-L. Goel is a job that usually the closest relative of a person has that helps to restore the dignity of a person who has had their dignity taken from them. Let's say a person is sold into slavery. If one's goel has the financial means to do it, to buy you out of slavery, then you do that and restore their dignity. But goel can also mean one's avenger, to the point of killing someone else if they have harmed you. So when Job says, I know my Redeemer, I know my goel liveth, we don't know for sure exactly what form of Redeemer Job is looking for. Is he looking for God to be his blood avenger for all that has happened? God does not answer Job for another 19 chapters. 19 more chapters of his friends giving him a hard time. And finally, God speaks, and God does not speak. The Redeemer does not speak as a blood avenger. The Redeemer speaks as the creator of the world, who looks at this world in all of its exquisite beauty, of all of its harmony and balance, and says, this is what I have made. This is what I have called you into. If we stopped and we looked at the story of Job just in these five verses and we focused on that one word, the goel, and we think of it as avenger, then the distorted, the picture might be quite distorted, but this is one set of pixels of which it contributes to the larger story. For he says, in the midst of the worst, I know that God, my Redeemer, lives. And God fills in the picture, begins to fill in the picture in the rest of Job of what that Redeemer is. The Redeemer is the creator of the world. It will be centuries later when Jesus will talk about the Redeemer and call the Redeemer Abba, Daddy. The picture gets more pixelated. We see more pixels in it, and it becomes just a little bit clearer. Three generations after Jesus, the evangelist John will say, God is love. Three words will pull it all together there. I know that my Redeemer liveth is one part of the larger picture that begins to get clearer and clearer and clearer. That full picture in which in this story from Luke, we get that not only does the Redeemer live, but the Redeemer is present with us in our very lives. That's what's happening in the book of Luke. It's chapter 20 in the book of Luke. If you follow the story of Luke, Jesus has entered into Jerusalem in Holy Week. He's had Palm Sunday. He's had this triumphant entry. And he has also gone into the temple and he has turned upside down the tables. He has taken a rope and he has whipped it and he has screamed at people. He has driven out the money changers from the temple. He is clearly a threat. Clearly a threat to the established order of Jerusalem at that time. He has an unorthodox theology, and he has this populist appeal that has the people who were so docile and controllable all of a sudden not so controllable. And so a group, the Sadducees, a sect of Judaism, that is A, very wealthy, very influential, very connected to the Roman occupiers, comes and they say, well, we want to have a little conversation with you. They make it look like it's a nice theological discourse. It has nothing to do with theological discourse. All they are trying to do is to trap him with his own words. Because if they can trap him, they can discredit him. And so they create this possible scenario, yet an incredibly improbable scenario. There's a man who dies and he and his widow have no children, and so the brother marries the woman, again no children, and this goes on seven times. So if you believe in the afterlife, Jesus, who's she married to? Which of those seven brothers? They think that they can confound him, because he must be a simpleton, this country bumpkin coming into the big city. His theology must be inconsistent. His theology must be anything that we don't need to worry about. But Jesus bests them. Jesus uses their very own words. He uses their very own hero, Moses, as an example here. And he not only uses Moses, but he uses the most sacred of realities in their tradition, that of the covenant that God has lifted up between Moses and all the ancestors and carried on from there, and uses it to prove that indeed God is the God of the living. God is the God of the living. God is the God of the present moment. Those are the pixels of the picture that we are beginning to see here. That's what Jesus is talking about. That whole theological discourse, push it aside, because it all is setting up for him to be able to say that one truth. God is the God of the living. That God who is my Redeemer, who lives, that Job tells us about, is also the God of our very present moment. And we can spend our time all we want to do spinning into theology and everything else, but hear this, that if you've lived a life worthy, whether it is now or when you have passed through the veil, you are alive and present with God, for God is the God of the living. When the disciples gathered together, when the early church gathered together, they gathered together to tell these stories, to begin to take the pixels and put them together in ways that would help to spread this understanding throughout the known world at that time. They told the stories of their faith. They told the stories of their times walking with Jesus. They told these stories, making this composite picture that was a beautiful and wonderful picture. And they also, I'm sure, allowed the very realities of their gathering together at the table to also tell the story. That it's not just in the Holy Scriptures that the story is told, that the story is told in this amazing creation that we live in. The story is told in the way in which we take the elements of the creation. We say that every time we sing that or say that wonderful Sunday school song, back of the bread is the grain. Back of the grain is the mill. Back of the mill is the sun and the rain and the Creator's loving will. Every time we say that, we are saying a truth that every spiritual tradition knows, that we are connected. We are connected to all that has been created, that we ourselves are made up of sunshine and rain. We are made up of humus and soil. We are made up of the very dust that every star and every galaxy in the universe is a part of. When they gathered together and they saw bread on the table, there was a story to be told. Go away. There was a story to be told. Certainly there's a story of that Last Supper. And the story of Jesus' call to them, that as life is being given and life is being broken, so too shall you do. But there is also a very story in the fact that they are breaking bread together around a table. The pixels that make up the story of our lives get more and more gathered together to make a more composite picture. And this bread that we have this morning, it's a story in itself as well. You may notice that this bread is in a challah form, a braided loaf. Challah is a bread that is used in many Jewish families for the high holy days, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Passover. It is also used for other holy days like Sukkot, a harvest festival that just happened within the Jewish world. And there are harvest festivals happening all around the world. And I just decided to make harvest festival bread from Ethiopia. Why Ethiopia? I'm looking, Jim just looked at me and went, why Ethiopia? Because in this last week, the Ethiopian government and the rebels, the Tigray rebels, came together and they created a peace agreement, tenuous as it is, but an agreement that has ended for the moment at least 2 years of conflict, that has left thousands killed, that has left hundreds of thousands in famine, that has left millions displaced. And they came together to say that maybe we who used to be looking at one another from the end of the sights of our guns in the last 2 years might instead be able to sit at the table together. It's part of the bigger story. The story that Job hints at when he says, my Redeemer liveth. The story that Jesus calls us to when Jesus says, God is the God of this moment right now, present with you in the lives that you choose to live. The story that is illustrated when a person like Martin Luther King says that quote that we so often say, the moral arc of the universe always bends towards justice. It is the story that we are called to, whether it is found in the Holy Word, in the scriptures, or whether it is found in bread, or whether it is found in the trees and the bees and everything that is out there. It is a story that we are invited to be a part of. A story that is ultimately a story of being called to one who is known as love, to one who calls us to be love. And so we gather together around this table with the elements that have been there for thousands of years. No longer do we have a cup, we will drop a grape into your hand. We have some of this very bread has already been cut up and broken for you. And in so doing, we will remember that the night in which he was betrayed, he took that bread and he broke it. He said, "This is my body which has been broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, he took a cup and he poured it. He says, "This is the blood of the new covenant that has been shed for you. Do this also in remembrance of me, that as life has been given to give life, so are you called to give and to share of your life that others may have life." And so it is. We share these elements. So we have the glutenated bread here. Ejito has the gluten-free bread somewhere. Is it that one there? We will walk around and we will share this with one another. And as you take it in, remember, you too are part of that story of the great picture that is being brought into this world at this very time. Amen.